Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
My guest today is Richard Ascroft, and today I just want to start with saying, you may have read the title of this episode, and I want to say we have a warning on this episode. Viewer discretion advised, because we are going to discuss Jesus Christ, and this might be a controversial episode. So if you are real or a Christian, you might not like what we have to say, and I just want to begin opening with that. You have been warned. Turn this episode off if you don't want to hear what we have to say, because we don't historically, maybe not from the Bible, we don't discuss the Bible as well, but we don't want to look at the facts as well. So if you don't like what I have to say, you might want to turn this episode off. This might not be for you. But Richard, how did you come, this might be obvious answer, but how did you come across studying the historical Jesus?
Yeah, it's a good question. Many people working in the field that I work in biblical studies, just get hooked on it because of historical curiosity. Some people get hooked on it because they grew up in the church and encountered the Bible that way. For me, it was a bit of both. I didn't grow up in the church, but in my teenage years, took an interest in the Bible, started going to a church. I no longer do go to a church, but it was in that period I got hooked on studying the history behind these texts and how these texts were constructed and what we can learn from them about the characters like Paul, like Peter, and like Jesus, of course.
And we discussed this off camera as well, because but the Bible is your main source of study, right? But if you go on studying historical Jesus, there can't be a lot, because it wasn't well known at the time. That became afterwards, right? Like a few decades, a few centuries. So there can't be a lot of work and sources around Jesus to study on for that era, other than the Bible, what he has to say. So it has to be kind of hard to do research, particularly if you want historical Jesus.
It's a particular challenge. The lack of sources, as you rightly point out, has not ever stopped the flow of people researching and producing books claiming to give an accurate picture of the historical Jesus. But we don't have any real, we have no archaeological evidence from Jesus himself, of course, very little from other kind of characters at that time, more so from the period he lived in terms of Greco-Roman archaeology. So we have a very good understanding of what life was like generally for people, but we don't have a lot of sources that talk about Jesus himself outside of the biblical texts from the first century. And the biblical texts themselves are fraught with difficulty in terms of reliability as historical sources.
And of course, we're going to come back to this, but I believe it was Pliny the Younger that's the first time we get Christians in Roman sources, right? When he's asked the emperor, what are we going to do with these Christians? And of course, you have Nero, who loves persecuting the Christians.
Yeah.
But I believe Pliny the Younger is the first time we kind of hear Christians in that term.
In that term, you get, that's early in the second century, around 110. But you also get Suetonius mentioning the persecution or at least prosecution of Christians under Nero. Tacitus does seem to mention that Christ was that a figure was crucified under Pontius Pilate. So these are all kind of clustered around the end of the first century, beginning of the second century. So we get a little bit of attestation for people who are following somebody named Christ than even that there was a figure named Christ. So very few people
determined that he was real. He was he did exist.
Yeah. Yeah, very few historians that certainly no one I know would deny there was somebody named Jesus from Nazareth who died on a Roman cross. Beyond that, then the sources become much more difficult to interpret. But it used to be people would say, well, he's a completely invented character. And there is credible historical evidence that he was a real person.
So let's begin this birth. And as we know, the Christian Gregorian calendar beginning year zero, but it's actually the I think stated that he was born not in the year zero as we sort of where we start from, but a few years earlier. So why aren't we saying 2027 right now or 2025, for example? And let's begin with the birth of Christ. This is kind of a two part question, but let's begin there.
Sure. Well, yeah, the dating question is interesting, and it takes us right to the heart of our sources. So in the Gospel of Matthew, it says that when Jesus was born, Herod the Great was alive. And that when Herod the Great was told about a Messiah in Bethlehem, he actually deployed people to go and kill babies in the hope to kill this Messiah. We know Herod the Great died somewhere between 6 and 4 BCE. So if Matthew's story is correct, then Jesus had to have been born before the supposed year zero. So it pushes it back. Now, we could also say, well, maybe that was an invented tradition so that Jesus was born at the fictional year zero. But people tend to sort of give some credence, at least, to Jesus being born in those 4 to 6 years earlier.
Now, this is a joke in Life of Brian, so we will, of course, go back to the movie again. But I heard another podcast as well last year, I think, where they said that there really was a lot of messiahs around in that time, pretending to be messiah. Yeah. Right? So it should have been didn't necessarily have to be Jesus at that time of Herod the Great, necessarily, right?
Yeah, no, correct. I mean, there were a lot of people who either claimed that they were the Messiah or other people claimed they were the Messiah. There were, so within Judaism, they were in a land, people living in Judea were living under Roman occupation. They were not happy about this. They were looking for God to break in. They'd gone through centuries of disruption to the overarching narrative of how God would bless them. And so they were looking for God to step up and step in and, you know, with some kind of kingly or prophetic Messiah. So people were looking. And of course, when people are looking, they can find what they want. And so there were many people that were claiming to be Messiah or were proclaimed Messiah. So Jesus wasn't alone. And so, yeah, some of these stories might have gotten mixed up or overlapped.
I wanted to ask because, you know, I did have a question, but let's talk about, I'll come back to that later, but let's talk about the controversial virgin birth. How was that? How can we interpret that into real events here?
So the Bible itself doesn't record the virgin birth. It records a virginal conception. Mary is proclaimed to be pregnant without the intervention of a male. The actual story of the virgin birth occurs in a second century document called the Proto-Evangelium Jacobi, or the first gospel of James. And that gives much more detail about how once Mary had delivered Jesus, all of her internal parts were still intact, that she had no evidence of ever having been pregnant and delivering a child. But the story itself, to go back to that, the virginal conception story, fits with other stories we know from the time that for special people that are set aside by the gods for some special purpose, that are either divinely conceived physically or in some kind of miraculous way. And so it's mapping Jesus onto other divine figures at the time.
No, well, what because you and I don't want to come back to this again. You submit, I mean, the, was when you get the Messiah, and you see this in other religions as well. Was it kind of a particular hard time to be Jewish in the Roman Empire? Is that why we have so many Messiahs wanting to bring the great, the good for the Jewish people? That is that why we have so many Messiahs that they want to make the Middle East something again? Is that could that be why we had why it was so many Messiahs in that era?
That would certainly explain the desire for liberation that we find at that time, and not just through a Messiah. It wasn't that everyone was looking for a Messiah. Other people had other ways, looking for restoring the sacrificial system. So the temple in Jerusalem became a focal point for the sacrifices. But the broader question was it tough to be Jewish under Roman occupation? The short answer is yes, but it was tough to be not Roman under Roman occupation, no matter where you were. I think it was particularly tough for for people in Judea because they're on the fringes of the empire. Generally, people that were put there administratively didn't want to be there. It was a conflict zone with other people, and also, and this is the big one. Because Jews are monotheists, the Romans didn't get it on the one hand. On the other hand, they did respect that Judaism was an ancient religion. So we even have evidence that they passed some laws banning collective groups, but they gave an exemption to Jewish groups because they had been around for so much longer than the other groups. So it's a funny dichotomy of it was a very rough time for Jews, but it also they did get some recognition and concessions, but begrudgingly, because the Romans really didn't know what to do with monotheists. They considered monotheists to be atheists because they denied all the other gods.
So let's talk about Joseph and Maria themselves. How do did they kind of try to promote that kind of like a child stars today kind of thing that their son because you had of course a story with the three wise men how and it kind of sounds like a kind of child star what you see today in Hollywood and how their parents kind of try to promote their child. Did they kind of try to do the same with their Jesus in a sense?
I would say no. I don't put a lot of credence into those stories, so I'm not sure. I mean, so let me back up and say I think every parent wants to promote their child as a child star. So they probably did. But those stories that we read now were written decades after Jesus died. So presumably he died somewhere between 27 and 33 years old. He and then those stories don't even get the narratives in Matthew and Luke aren't written down probably for another 40 to 50 years, even if the stories have been circulating. And the story, for example, of the wise men and Matthew and the one we mentioned about Herod killing the 2-year-olds and the fleeing to Egypt, that just sounds too much like a rewriting of the story of Moses. And so I don't think it was the parents promoting Jesus as a child. I think it's Matthew promoting Jesus through a story about events around his birth and his early childhood. So I think there is promotion there, but I think it's Matthew is writing that promotional material.
So let's talk about his childhood, what it may actually have been like. When did he start to kind of see it feel like how what it was like growing up? And because Joseph was a carpenter, right? That's what he did. And what was it like? What was he going to become an apprentice of Joseph? Because he wasn't the only child, was he? And they did have brothers and sisters at that time.
It's the text. So in the biblical text itself, it talks about Jesus having brothers and sisters. Different Christian denominations interpret that differently. Some suggest these are stepbrothers from Joseph's previous marriage. Others suggest that these are actually cousins. And that's because, of course, they don't want to say Mary had more children, that she was always a virgin. And others just say, no, he had brothers and sisters. But yes, he would have grown up, it seems, in a little town, the little village of Nazareth, probably, what, 100 families. Probably not well to do, but it's in the Galilee. Joseph, it says the text say Joseph was a carpenter. The pattern that we would expect is that any son of a carpenter would apprentice under his father and take on that kind of business. It seems unlikely to me that he was a carpenter that like whittled little tiny trinkets. He more likely did bigger construction. And at one point, we know there's the construction of Sepphoris, which is a major town that the Romans were working on that overlaps the time Jesus would be growing up. And it's about an hour's walk each way. Conceivably, Joseph could have walked there every day in the morning and done construction work as a carpenter in that city. And then Jesus would have followed once he started apprenticing, probably at a fairly young age. Do I have any direct evidence that Jesus did that? No. All of this comes from, like, archaeologically, what did Nazareth look like? What did Sepphoris look like? What were patterns for people at that time? But we don't have any direct evidence that Jesus did exactly what I just said.
No, I'm not very I must confess that I'm not very familiar with Jewish history myself. I'm going to read a book soon about Jewish history in Europe, but I'm not really familiar. And as you know, Jerusalem is a religious city, and as we will see, it will be 1,000 years later under the Crusades, it will be a very controversial city as well. But what was Jerusalem's status at the time of Jesus? Because does seem to spend a lot of time there as well.
Yeah, Jerusalem was, it was the capital in terms of the most important city, and religiously, economically, politically, it was the draw everywhere. And that during the time that Jesus was alive, the temple was still standing and still operating in Jerusalem. And so with the temple, there was a whole system of sacrifices that people could go to the temple and make a sacrifice, asking God to forgive them for their sins, or asking for special blessings. And people would make pilgrimages to Jerusalem to do that, or they might go there on Passover for a celebration where there would be extra sacrifices. Once a year, the high priest would enter into the Holy of Holies to ask for forgiveness on behalf of the nation. So it's very important religiously. But also that's where, politically you would have had the main administrative body of the Romans would have operated out of there. Not just there. They were also at Caesarea Maritima, which is a city on the coast, which was probably much more pleasant for the Roman administrators than was Jerusalem. They would not have liked being in Jerusalem, but they knew it was necessary. But Jerusalem could also then be a hotbed of sedition, of rebellion. And so there were groups that were not just opposed to the Romans, but violently opposed. They actually would enact violence on Roman administrators. So, you know, from the Jewish point of view, these are freedom fighters. They're fighting for the freedom of the Jewish people. From the Roman point of view, these are terrorists. And, you know, this is always the rhetoric. It depends what side you're on.
And of course, it got 70 somewhat years later, the revolt of Judea.
Yeah. So in 68, it explodes into a war, and where the Jews are thoroughly defeated, and the temple is torn down, never to be rebuilt. So in 70, that temple gets destroyed. And that's the end of sacrifice. That's the end of the sacrificial system. Mm-hmm. But this might be a good place to then just say, in the Bible, it talks about Sadducees and Pharisees coming to Jesus. The Sadducees were the ones that would have been linked to Jerusalem and the sacrificial system. But the Pharisees would have been teachers, and that's where we would place Jesus. He was a rabbi. He was a teacher. He was like the Pharisees, trying to interpret Torah, the law, for everyday life. How do I live? What does God want me to do in this situation or in this situation? And so Jesus is a teacher in that vein. And so his disciple simply means student. He gathered students around him and he was teaching them how to live according to Jewish law. This is what he was doing.
How does it go on about doing this? Does it go on a kind of press tour, propaganda tour in a sense?
Yeah, in some ways he probably started, I mean, again, this is my fabrication. I can't prove this definitively, but going by patterns, he maybe even talked to people while he was working, and they realized maybe he was a bit more insightful about Torah than other people were, and they came to him to ask him questions, and then he starts to take on that role of teacher. And I suspect at a certain point he's got enough people that are interested in him. They say, you know what, we should go to a different city. The people there want to hear you talk. And so they go to Capernaum on the coast, or they go.
So he wasn't just an orator.
It seems that to attract disciples like that, you would need to be a good orator. Yes. Yeah.
Of course, I want to go back a little further. When does he realize that he wanted to be a rabbi? Because he, of course, had a famous story in the Bible where he goes to the temple and his mother finds him there and he says, oh, I want to be close to my father.
Yeah.
You got the famous story. So, but when does he become real? When they have an idea that a rabbi is what they want to become?
Yeah, again, that story, it's only in Luke's gospel. And, you know, it actually, you know, I don't think it happened historically exactly the way Luke told it, but it does reflect what many parents, myself included, find with children, that you have hopes that they will do one thing, but they decide they want to do something else. Mm-hmm. And so it certainly rings true with, you know, Joseph might have said, I want my son to be a carpenter like me. But Jesus might have been much more drawn to reading books or at least arguing with other teachers. And so it's hard to know when he realized that he wanted to do something different. But that story probably started circulating as a way to say very early on, this guy named Jesus, not only knew he wanted to be a teacher, but proved himself by talking to teachers that were much older than he was.
So, of course, we talked about how to talk about as well is the name of Jesus. So while it is, we call him in the English version Jesus, but it was more like Josephus would be more likely, right?
Yeah, it'd be Yeshua, which technically would be Joshua.
Joshua, that's right.
In Hebrew, or in Aramaic, but the texts we have are all written in Greek, and so they write the name Yeshua in Greek letters is Jesus. So this is how we know him. But that's, if you went to Nazareth in the first century and said, you know, where's Jesus? They would have understood, but they would have paused for a minute, like, oh, you mean Yeshua, right? Or Joshua.
Something we have to discuss, and this might, I don't know how many people need to hear this. I mean, this just is offline as well, but not offline, but off the record, and that Jesus was definitely not white.
Most definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, just going by patterns, he's in the area that, for better or worse, we call the Middle East. And so, you know, his complexion would have been much darker than is often depicted in paintings that are coming out of Europe. Throughout, so you know, from the early days on through the Renaissance and things in North America, particularly in the United States, there's a famous picture that was given to veterans returning from the war in the 40s. It's a painting by Werner Eck, and it's a portrait of Jesus. He's got these pasty white skin and blue eyes and long flowing hair, and so all of these houses had this picture of Jesus. And so people growing up said, oh, that's what Jesus looks like. Well, it's nothing at all what Jesus looked like. He wouldn't have had blonde hair. He wouldn't have had blue eyes. And he certainly wouldn't have been white-skinned and pasty white-skinned at that. Yeah, but every movie that comes out through the 50s and 60s, especially the 60s, that depicts Jesus casts a white American or a white European in that role.
So we talked earlier about how there were several messiahs at the time. Did Jesus look at himself as kind of a messiah at this point, or did he just want to be an orator, like a normal rabbi?
Yeah, there's a lot of debate about whether Jesus at a certain point realized that he was somehow special and set apart. And so messiah or messiah is the Hebrew really just means anointed by God. So the way David was, so especially set apart by God. So in the Gospels, it there are stories of Jesus going around teaching, saying things like love God, love your neighbor, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. He's simply teaching ways to live. That sounds like a something a rabbi would do. But there's also passages where he goes around with woe, say woe to you, Jerusalem, or tells a story about how when people die, they will be judged. Either sheep go to heaven or goats and go to eternal damnation. But that's what we call apocalyptic theology. If it's hard to know whether Jesus is one or the other or both. But with that apocalyptic theology, it does move a person beyond just being a rabbi, just being a teacher, into something more, that they must have had a self-awareness of, seeing themselves as God's agent. So I do think Jesus did get there. I think Jesus, I mean, my reading of the text is they don't just invent that for Jesus. He really thought he would have a hand in bringing about the end of the world.
Whereas Paris like, oh, we don't have enough messiahs these days.
Yeah. I think any messiah, thinks of themselves as having a hand in God's work, but thinks that the others don't. He doesn't seem to put himself up against anyone else that we know. We know of the other messianic movements from other sources, not from him. He does more battle with the Sadducees and Pharisees.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you if the other messiah stood alone, or if this was kind of a brawl fight between them, like, I'm the wrong messiah. No, that's me.
No, I think I think Monty Python's movie, The Life of Brian, satirizes that. I think that does it. But we don't get evidence of that kind of fight. One of the other people that
Messiah fight.
Right, exactly. Well, I think where the competition lied for early Christians were in followers of John the Baptist, who thought John the Baptist was the Messiah. And so then the stories, by the time they make it into the Gospels, have exactly that. In John's Gospel, John the Baptist literally says, "Why are you following me? There's Jesus. You should follow him. He's the real Messiah." So it's not a Messiah fight. The fight's already been won. Yeah. That, to be honest, though, that's written so much later. I do think early on there was competition between the followers of John the Baptist and the followers of Jesus.
So let's talk about some of the mythological things that happens in the Bible, like him turning water into wine. And I kind of picture how this goes. Okay, Jesus is like, hey, look over there, that's the Roman emperor. And quickly, let's just switch the glasses with wine before they turn around. But when does this story send turn into a blind man and him walking the water? That was a later, right? That wasn't something.
These stories are almost certainly from later. And, the miraculous elements get added to it. I'm sure Jesus was compassionate. I'm sure he went to see the sick, and I'm sure he talked to them and maybe even laid hands on them to bless them. But in the stories that are told later, there's some kind of miraculous cure that takes place, or he's able to calm stormy waters, or as you say, turn water into wine, or produce 5,000 loaves of fish. And scholars have struggled with, just as you say, did something really happen, but it was some kind of trick? Or are these literary creations that are meant to enhance Jesus' reputation later? And to be honest, they're told in the same way you would expect a healing story to be told. So in English, at least, if I were to say, once upon a time, there lived a young boy in the forest. By saying once upon a time, you would know right away that this is a fairy tale, that this is an invented story. There's little hints like that in the stories about Jesus' miracles that tell us that they're just writing miracle stories the way you would write a miracle story for anyone. That they're not necessarily written as sort of objective history.
Another one we have to talk about is Judas as well. And, the synonym for traitor this day, it's still today. So when does Judas come into the picture with Jesus?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. So one of the things we don't dispute very much is that Jesus died as crucified on a Roman cross. I mean, it's got a little bit of attestation outside of the New Testament. Dying on a Roman cross was dying as a criminal. It's not a he didn't die for his religious beliefs. He died politically. So that's important. The Jews would have stoned him for blasphemy if it was a religious fight, but he was crucified, which means it's something political. So at some point he must have made it onto the radar of the Roman authorities that they would want to, they had very little tolerance for anybody that was disruptive. And so he likely was being disruptive through his actions and through his words. So whether or not Judas betrayed him, he probably had disciples who were committed at various levels, some of whom wanted to follow him right into battle and others who were more reluctant. But that gets theologized that, you know, that John's gospel says the devil entered into Judas in order to make him betray Jesus. I think that's a literary way of getting Jesus onto the cross without being a criminal. That is, Judas is an attempt to decriminalize Jesus in the writings. But the church struggled with it and still does. So Judas is vilified for his actions. He's, as you say, he's called the betrayer. And yet without him, Jesus doesn't get to the cross. And so could live to be an old man. And that affects all of the Christian theology around salvation. So there's
About it that way, to be honest. Yeah. That's something I just realized when you mentioned that you don't have a good point there.
Yeah. Yeah. What if he doesn't get betrayed? He dies as an old man, some old carpenter up in Nazareth. So there's a fourth century document called the Gospel of Judas that struggles with this and has Jesus literally say to Judas, I want you to do this. Everybody's going to hate you, but this is your job. You have to do this. And there's some hints of that even in the Gospels when he says, I know one of you is going to betray me. It's like he almost knows this has to happen.
So something we have to discuss about as well is there's a few characters we have to discuss as well here. It's Maria Magdalena. Well, yeah. I think that's what she called, right? It's been a while since I did done Christian in research myself, but I believe that's what she called, right? And
yeah.
Were in romantic relations with Jesus as far as was she an invented character or was there evidence that they were romantically involved?
Not unless you read Dan Brown's book. No, but there are other books that make this claim. Even before Dan Brown popularized it in the Da Vinci Code. No, there wasn't. At least not in that. There's no evidence in the biblical text that there was a romantic relationship there. There is evidence in Luke's gospel. It says that Mary Magdalena was financing Jesus and the disciples. In Luke chapter 8, it says that she and two other women that are named and then some other women were paying their bills because you can't just walk. It's like touring today. You have to pay. You have expenses when you're traveling around. So, and if Jesus isn't working, who's paying for the places where they're staying? Who's buying their food? Who's paying for the food for donkeys and things? Well, Mary was one of those people. Mary Magdalena, but that really just means Mary, the one from Magdala, which is a town on the seashore of the Sea of Galilee. Or the Lake of Galilee. That's to distinguish her from all the other Marys that existed at that time.
So how does she come across Jesus? How does she become, like you said, finance his career, to put it that way?
She's probably a wealthy woman, or at least middle-class woman, who is interested in philosophy, interested in, as a thinker, and has access to her own funds. And so we know, because of some Augustan laws, that came in prior to when Jesus was born. There were opportunities during the first century for women to gain a little bit of independence over their finances. And so we meet a number of these women in the Bible, Phoebe, who's funding Paul, Lydia, who has her own household, Chloe, who has her own household. And I would put Mary into that category. In Luke, she's grouped with Susanna, the wife of Chuza, who is the chief steward of Herod. This is not an insignificant position. He's basically the treasurer for one of Herod the Great's sons. She's probably fairly well off as well. So Jesus and his disciples are being funded by these well-off people. The one thing that Mary is not, is she's not a prostitute. Mm. But she becomes a prostitute in the third century in the tradition. And there's a whole interesting history there. But early on in the text, there's no indication at all that she was involved in prostitution or that that's how she got her money. That's a later fabrication.
So, and I think the last character we have to discuss as well is, of course, Pontius Pilatus, who is one of the most controversial characters in the Bible. Even though he doesn't appear much, he's a huge significance in the story. And I was watching a documentary quite a while ago on Pontius Pilatus, and in the Bible he's portrayed as weak, right? He's not a very strong character, but in if you go into real life there, he was just a senator doing his job, right? He was persecuting criminals. That's what he had to do to keep the law and order in Jerusalem, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And probably like all Roman administrators out in provinces, he probably would prefer to be anywhere else. Well, no, he probably prefer to be in Rome. But he would know that he had to serve a certain amount of time in different provinces. And this was
common if you wanted to become a senator, right? You had to serve 5 years abroad, I think, to become a Roman senator, be a governor somewhere.
If you're going to move up the food chain, so you already had to be elite. Mm. And then to move up the food chain and, yes, eventually get to be a senator, you had to do your service. And you made some money along the way through taxation. So I don't think he's necessarily weak. You're right. The Bible does portray him that way as being weak. You know, his wife tells him what to do based on a dream, and he lets the crowds tell him what to do. He's not presented as a very strong.
I have a very good friend in Rome.
Exactly. Yes, again, Monty Python gets that kind of weakness there and satirizes it well.
You find it funny when I say,
there is evidence for his existence, and that's one of the interesting pieces. There was an inscription with his name on, found in Caesarea Maritima. Hmm. So the reference in Tacitus mentions. Hmm. The Jewish Messiah being Christ, called Christus, a misspelling, crucified. It's interesting. You had said that they persecuted them, but because of Roman law. So I try and avoid that word persecution and say prosecuted, because actually their laws were harsh, but he had every right to prosecute them. In the same way, if you drive too fast on a road and you get pulled over by the police for speeding, you can't say you were persecuted. You were prosecuted.
And like you said, and this is a joke in Life of Brian as well, like where Brian says that he is a Roman citizen, but they don't believe him, so he's just crucified. And you cannot be crucified, like we talked about, if you're a Roman citizen. But Jesus wasn't a Roman citizen, was he?
No. No, not at all. No, it would be very rare for a Jewish person to be a Roman citizen. You really would have to have, at that time, citizenship was more difficult to obtain. And you would have had to marry into it or, you know, buy your way in the way it said that some people do in Acts. It mentions it. Being born into it would give you more status than if you purchased it. But it's unlikely a carpenter's son from the backwaters of the Galilee wouldn't have been a Roman citizen.
So now we have to talk about the before the crucifixion as well, when Pilatus says, should I free Jesus or this other random guy that you don't really want?
Yeah.
Evidence for this, that this was this kind of common thing, like this guy or this other guy? Who should we crucify?
There's evidence that a governor could have clemency that way, but not that this was a an actual regularized practice that and that it would have fallen to Jesus or Barabbas. Again, I think that's that story is there to highlight just how harshly all the people had turned against Jesus. Mm-hmm. And at this point in the story in Matthew and in John's gospel, this is where the writings themselves become horrifically anti-Semitic. And those texts have been used throughout history have been weaponized against Jews to say, you know, oh, it's your fault that the Romans killed Jesus.
Christians aren't very good at nothing to Joe, are they?
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like forgetting that the Romans had full autonomy and acted. Mm. They would never have been pushed around by a Jewish mob to do what the Jewish mob wanted. And Jesus was killed as a Roman political prisoner. So, but the stories are structured in a way that says, oh, it's the fault of the Jews at that time. And then throughout history, those texts have been used by Christians to persecute the Jews for being at fault. Whereas it's very clear historically, it's a Roman execution, not a Jewish execution.
Of course, something that we have to talk about. And I heard this on another podcast as well. And I think it was on, I don't know about that, but with Jim Jeffries, I think a while ago, he was talking about religion last year, I think. And they said that, and I keep bringing this up, but I feel like it's important to bring up that there was a lot of messiahs around. So why did Jesus really, but first I actually want to ask, did he intend to create a whole new religion, or was that by accident?
The short answer is no, he did not. I think that was by accident. Was he attempting to reform Judaism, to bring it back to its roots? Sure, yeah, I think he was trying to do that. I don't think he was trying to break it off into a new religion. I think that all of that comes later on. So why did he then get attention drawn to himself? There are some stories in the text, like when he goes to the Jerusalem temple and he overturns tables of the money changers. That's a political act, a highly visible political act. That's the kind of thing that gets you arrested by the Romans. So he either did that or something like that, that drew attention to himself. Because there were a lot of people, as you say, messiahs walking around saying stuff, and the Romans ignored them. So Jesus must have done something to draw attention to himself beyond sort of I want to look beyond what the Bible says it is, because there they have, you know, Jewish leadership getting involved and Judas betraying him. That seems to me to be very contrived. But actions like overturning a table in the temple, that will get you arrested.
So we have to talk about after as well, and after Jesus, and how did the Bible, New Testament, or as I call it, the reboot, come about?
Yeah. So it took about 350 years beyond the death of Jesus, a little bit more, to come up with the New Testament that we know. I think the earliest texts we have in the New Testament are actually the letters of Paul. And he wrote those letters to communities that he founded to help them grow and develop. But even in those letters, he thought Jesus was coming back during his lifetime. He truly believed that Jesus had died and had been raised from the dead and was going to return. And this would be the end of the world. And this is how Paul is like other Jewish
Doesn't that technically make Jesus a supervillain, though, that they're going to destroy the world?
It does if you like the world. It doesn't if you don't like the world. Mm. And so for someone like Paul or other apocalyptic people, it was what was going to happen is God was going to restore the world to where it should be, because people like the Romans had made it worse. Mm. So then...
What did the Romans ever do for us?
Exactly. Yeah. Except for all of these things, what have they ever done? But see, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much they've done. People wanted, you know, God to be back in charge. And in a sense, they wanted not to be under Roman occupation. So this is what they really were imagining. And when that didn't happen, and people like Paul started dying, they had to rethink the timeline. And it's at that point that they said, hey, we should write down some of the stories about Jesus. We better write down some of the things he said so we don't forget them. So it's not until probably the earliest gospel is Mark. It was probably written to around the year 70, 68 to 70 of the first century. So this is 35, 40 years after Jesus said and did these things. That's a long time. There were probably some other people that wrote notes and things down before that that Mark might have used. But it's not until they realize the end of the world is not happening that they say we need some stories. And for them to become the New Testament takes another 250 years.
So what is the earliest version of the New Testament? Because today we have all this different interpretation, like a King James Bible, for example, you got the Catholic Bible, you got the Protestant Bible, you got the Orthodox Bible, to mention just some versions. So what is the earliest version? Have you read the earliest version of the Bible?
Well, let's just put it this way. We don't have any of the originals. There's a fragment from the Gospel of John. It's a small piece of papyrus, which is what they used to write on, called P52, papyrus number 52. And that fragment comes from maybe the year 125. That would be the earliest evidence we have for a piece of the New Testament. We don't actually get a full New Testament in a book until much later, until the fourth and fifth century. We get lots of pieces and fragments of it before that. But that's, of course, all in Greek. And then it gets getting translated into Aramaic and Armenian and Syriac and Coptic. But we don't get, you know, in English, the first English translation isn't until, 15, 1600s, when people are doing, German, French, English translations, so people could start reading it on their own.
And because Latin was, especially in the Catholic Church, right? Latin was the prominent.
Yeah.
Right. And we talked about this briefly in the Holy Roman Empire episode as well, that the Christianity was mostly for the rich people who actually knew Latin, right?
Yeah. Jerome translated the Greek and Hebrew into Latin, and that became used in the church and carried on when the split between Orthodox and the rest of the church in the year 1000-ish, and then in Protestants when they split when Martin Luther in the 1600s or in the 16th century, what was today the Catholic Church maintained sort of credence in that Latin text.
Because there is an extra chapter between the Bible and the Old Testament in the Catholic Church, I believe.
Yeah, and the Catholic Church has an extra 7 books, and the Orthodox Church has those 7 plus an extra one. So, if you ask a Catholic how many books are in their Bible, it's more than a Protestant. And it's these texts are
more to read.
That's more to read. But they have it. It's why, say, the doctrine of purgatory, which is only in the Catholic Church, comes out of one of those books that Protestants don't have.
So and I wanted to refer to the Jim Jeffries podcast again, the episode that talked about religion, because something I found fascinating, because the Christianity prevailed. It wasn't easy to be a Christian the first 300 years under Romans. You had, like you talked about, Nero, who persecuted the Christians, and they were pretty much persecuted. And I read The Darkening Age, but I don't remember the author. It's behind me right here, but I don't remember the author's name. But she talked about, and this is, of course, she claims that it was over-exaggerated, that it almost became, what's the word for it? They hoped almost to get sacrificed, that there was disappointment if there's something to sacrifice for a Christian cause almost the first 300 years. But when Christian, sorry for talking quite a lot now. Sorry for if you have to hear my voice quite a lot now. But when Constantine became Christian and Christianized Rome, and then, again, this is what to say said in the Jim Jeffries podcast, they just had to find a random place in. Oh, this is where Jesus came from, right? And this is where he died on the cross, right here.
Yeah,
just attract tourists more or less. Like kind of this where he died, this is a cave, and that when you go to Jerusalem, there is all this. I haven't been there, but he said that when you go there, there's all so many different places that this is the true Mary that died and came. to Lyman and so many places that claims to be the cave that he died in, right?
Yeah. Yeah, this is the finding of holy sites by Constantine's mother is just as you said. It was she kind of went out there to find places for pilgrims to go to, and then also found things like pieces of the cross that were given to churches across the empire, so that if you couldn't go to Jerusalem, you could go to one of these churches.
And you got the Holy Lance as well.
Yeah, yeah, the lance, the chalice, which, you know, supposedly has been lost, which Indiana Jones was, among many others, was looking for. This is how you make a religion, the religion of empire. And, you know, Constantine decided, I think for highly political reasons, that Christianity would be useful in his solidification of his power. And so he declared Christianity would now be licit. Constantine himself didn't ban other religions, but he said Christianity would no longer be prosecuted under the law, with a law that forbade certain kinds of religious practice. And so then, but that's not enough. You need to do something special to highlight it. And I think what he did is, you know, his mother at least was deployed to go and find all these sites. To draw pilgrims there and to sort of show how important Christianity was.
No, there is in Sonoria, I believe, and there's a Norwegian crusader during the first crusade, Sigurd Jorsalfar. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He was the first king, and we said this in the previous podcast, I think, but he was the first king to go to Jerusalem to go to crusading, and he got a part of the through cross, apparently, but it dates back, go back 1,000 years again to this day, to 2020, early 2010s. They did a DNA scan on the true cross to find out if it was. A spoiler alert, it wasn't.
So the story goes that if you took all the pieces of the cross that are in churches across mostly Europe, the actual historical cross was 1 mile high and half a mile wide. That's how many pieces there are, which, you know, is impossible, an impossibility. But all if it's so clearly not every piece
Jesus
of
wood. Must have been tall. Yeah.
Well, there is a second there's a second century document that has a cross that's as tall as the cloud, so maybe it's true, but I think not. There's way too much wood out there to have been the real cross. Some of it might have been, I doubt that.
There is a joke by a Norwegian comedian where he talks about how people have grown a few centimeters, like every century we grow a little more. And it makes sense that Jesus should walk on water, he says, because he was just a tiny little person. He was so light that he could have just walked on the water because he was so tiny.
Yeah, well, and it would also explain why Peter got knocked over by a wave, just couldn't stand up to it.
Yeah,
I mean, one of that was one of the curious things in the 1800s when they believed those stories were true, but that they weren't miracles. And they said, "Oh well, Jesus knew where the sandbank was underneath the surface of the water, so he's actually walking on a sandbank." And Peter doesn't know, so he goes the wrong way and falls in the water.
I think just cool you there.
Yeah, I think it's easier just to say the story was made up.
Yeah. So. Thank you so much for coming on. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Before I go, do you have anything you want to promote on the social media where people might find you? And links you want me to put in the description before you go?
No, thank you for having me on this. I'm not much on social media. All I do is watch podcasts like yours. So I'd say I'm not trying to compete with you. So keep up the good work.
Thank you very much for coming on. It has been a pleasure to have you on. This has been With That Age 12. We are available on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Instagram, With That Age 12. Please like, share, subscribe. If you are on Apple Podcasts, please write a review. That will help us out a lot. And I hope you like this episode. Please check out some of the other episodes we have. You're definitely going to find something you like. This has been With That Age 12. My name is Alan. I'll see you next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.